Chapter 56. Paris. In the aftermath, during the inevitable post-mortem and deconstruction that follows an affair of this magnitude, there was spirited debate over who among its far-flung cast of characters bore the most responsibility for its outcome. One participant was not asked for an opinion, and would surely not have ventured one if he had been. He was a man of few words, a man who stood a lonely post. His name was Rami, and his job was to keep watch over a national treasure, the Mamouna. Rami had been at the old man's side for the better part of 20 years. He was Shamron's other son, the one who stayed at home while Gabriel and Nabot were running around the world playing the hero. He was the one who snuck the old man's cigarettes and kept his Zippo filled with lighter fluid, the one who sat up nights on the terrace in Tiberias, listening to the old man's stories for the 1,000th time and pretending it was still the first. And he was the one who was walking exactly 20 paces behind the old man's back at 4 the following afternoon as he entered the Jardin des Tuileries in Paris. Chevron found Sergei Korobin where he said he would be, seated ramrod straight on a wooden bench near the Jeu de Paume. He was wearing a heavy woolen scarf beneath his overcoat and smoking the stub of a cigarette that left no doubt about his nationality. As Chevron sat down, Korobin raised his left arm slowly and pondered his wristwatch.
"You're 2 minutes late, Ari. That's not like you."
"The walk took me longer than expected."
"Bullshit."
Korobin lowered his arm.
"You should know that patience isn't one of Ivan's strong suits. That's why he was never selected to work in the first chief directorate. He was deemed too impetuous for pure espionage. We had to assign him to the fifth, where his temper could be put to good use."
"Breaking heads, you mean?"
Korobin gave a noncommittal shrug.
"Someone had to do it. He must have been a great disappointment to his father."
"Ivan, he was an only child. He was indulged."
"It shows."
Chamron removed a silver case from the pocket of his overcoat and took his time lighting a cigarette. Korobin, annoyed, gave his wristwatch another distracted glance.
"Perhaps I should have made something clear to you, Ari. This deadline was more than hypothetical. Ivan is expecting to hear from me. If he doesn't, chances are your agent will turn up somewhere with a bullet in the back of her head."
"That would be rather foolish, Sergei. You see, if Ivan kills my agent, he'll lose his only chance of getting his children back."
Korobin's head turned sharply in Chamron's direction.
"What are you saying, Ari? Are you telling me the Americans have agreed to return Ivan's children to Russia?"
"No, Sergei, not the Americans. It was Elena's decision. As you might expect, it's torn her to pieces, but she wants no more bloodshed because of her husband."
Chamron paused.
"And she also knows her children well enough to realize that they'll leave Russia the moment they're old enough and come back to her."
Age seemed to have taken a toll on Korobin's ability to dissemble. He exhaled a cloud of smoke into the Parisian dusk and did a very poor job of concealing his surprise at the development.
"What's wrong, Sergei? You told me Ivan wanted his children."
Chamron watched the Russian carefully.
"It makes me think your offer wasn't a serious one."
"Don't be ridiculous, Ari. I'm just stunned you were actually able to pull it off."
"I thought you learned a long time ago never to underestimate me."
The gardens were receding into the gathering darkness. Chamron glanced around, then settled his gaze on Korobin.
"Are we alone, Sergei?"
"They're alone."
"Anyone listening?"
"No one."
"You're sure?"
"No one would dare. I may be old, but I'm still Korobin."
"And I'm still Chamron. So listen carefully, because I'm not going to say this twice. On Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock Washington time, the Russian ambassador to the United States is to present himself at the main gate of Andrews Air Force Base. He will be met there by base security and a team of officers from the CIA and the State Department. They will take him to a VIP lounge, where he will be allowed to spend a few minutes with Anna and Nikolai Karkov."
Chamron paused.
"Are you with me, Sergei?"
"2 p.m., Thursday, Andrews Air Force Base."
When the meeting is over, the children will be placed aboard a C-32, the military's version of a Boeing 757. It will land in Russia at precisely 9 a.m. Friday morning. The Americans want to use the airfield outside Konakovo. Do you know the one I'm talking about, Sergei? It's the old air base that was converted to civilian use when your Air Force couldn't figure out how to fly planes anymore. Kuroven lit another of his Russian cigarettes and slowly waved out the match. 9 o'clock. The airfield outside Konakovo. Elena doesn't want the children walking off the plane into the arms of some stranger. She insists Ivan come to the airport and greet them. If Ivan isn't there, the children don't get off that plane. Are we clear on that, Sergei?
No, Ivan, no children.
At 9:05, the aircraft will be parked with its doors open. If my agent is standing outside the entrance of the Israeli embassy in Moscow, the children will walk off that plane. If she's not there, the crew will fire up those engines and take off again. And don't get any ideas about playing rough with that aircraft. It's American soil. And at 9 a.m. on Friday morning, the American president will be sitting down with the Russian president and the other group of 8 leaders for a working breakfast at the Kremlin. We wouldn't want anything to spoil the mood, would we, Sergei?
Say what you like about our president, Ari, but he is a man who respects international law.
If that's true, then why does your president allow Ivan to flood the most volatile corners of the world with Russian weapons? And why did he allow Ivan to kidnap one of my officers and use her as doctor to get his children back?
Greeted by silence, Chamron said,
I suppose it all comes down to money, doesn't it, Sergei? How much money did your president demand of Ivan? How much did Ivan have to pay for the privilege of kidnapping Grigori and my agent?
A president is a servant of the people. These stories of his personal wealth are lies in Western propaganda designed to discredit Russia and keep it weak.
You're showing your age, Sergei.
Kuroven ignored the remark. As for your missing agent, Ivan had absolutely nothing to do with her disappearance. I thought I made that clear during our first meeting.
Oh, yes, I remember. But let me make something clear to you now. If my agent isn't returned safe and sound at 9 o'clock Friday morning, I'm going to assume that you and your client were acting in bad faith. And it's going to make me very angry.
Ivan isn't my client. I'm just a messenger.
No, you're not. You're Kuroven.
Chamron watched the traffic hurtling around the Place de la Concorde.
Do you know the identity of the agent Ivan is holding?
I know very little.
Chamron gave a disappointed smile. You used to be a better poker player, Sergei. You know exactly who she is. And you know exactly who her husband is. And that means you know what's going to happen if she isn't released.
Chamron dropped the end of his cigarette onto the gravel footpath.
But just so there are no misunderstandings, I'm going to spell it out for you. If Ivan kills her, I'm going to hold the Kremlin responsible, and then I'm going to unleash my service on yours. No Russian intelligence officer anywhere in the world will be able to walk the streets without feeling our breath on the back of his neck.
Chamron placed his hand on Kuroven's forearm.
Are we clear, Sergei?
We're clear, Ari.
Good. And there's one other thing. I want Grigori Volkanov, and don't tell me he's none of my concern.
Kuroven hesitated, then said, He'll see.
2 p.m. Thursday, Andrews Air Force Base. 9 a.m. Friday, the airfield at Konakovo. 9 a.m. Friday, my agent outside our embassy in Moscow. Don't disappoint me, Sergei. Many lives will be lost if you do.
Chamron rose without another word and headed toward the Louvre, with Rami now walking vigilantly at his side. The bodyguard had not been able to hear what had just transpired, but was certain of one thing. The old man was still the one in charge, and he had just put the fear of God in Sergei Kuroven.
Chapter 57. Shannon Airport, Ireland. The name Aaron Davis of the White House Office of Presidential Advance was unfamiliar to them. Their orders, however, were unambiguous. They were to pick him up during the Shannon refueling stop and get him into Moscow without a hitch. And don't try to talk to him during the flight. He's not the talkative sort. They didn't ask why. They were Secret Service. They were never told his real name or the country of his birth. They never knew that their mysterious passenger was a legend, or that he had spent the previous 48 hours in London engaged in advance work of quite another kind, shuttling between Grosvenor Square and the Israeli embassy in Kensington. Though he was visibly fatigued and on edge, all those who encountered Gabriel during this period would later remember his extraordinary composure. Not once did he lose his temper, they said. Not once did he show the strain. His team, physically worn after 2 weeks in the field, responded with lightning speed to his calm but relentless pressure. Just 12 hours after the call to Elena Kharkov, half were on the ground in Moscow, credentials around their necks, covers intact. The rest joined them later that night, including the chief of special ops, Uzi Nabot. No other service in the world would have put so senior a man on the ground in so hostile a land. But then, no other service was quite like the office. Chamlon remained at Gabriel's side for all but a few hours. When he returned to Paris to hold the hand of Sergei Korobin, Ivan was getting nervous. Ivan was dubious about the entire thing. Ivan didn't understand why he had to wait until Friday to get his children back.
"He wants to do it now," Korobin said. "He wants it over and done with."
Chamlon did not tell his old friend that he already knew this, or that the NSA had been kind enough to share the original recording along with a transcript. Instead, he assured the Russian there was no need to worry. Elena just needed some time to prepare the children and herself for the pending separation.
Surely even a monster like Ivan can understand how difficult this is going to be on her.
As for the schedule, Chamlon made it clear there would be no changes. 2 p.m. at Andrews, 9 a.m. at Konakovo, 9 a.m. at the Israeli embassy in Moscow. No Ivan, no children, no Kiara, no safe place for any Russian intelligence officer on Earth.
And don't forget, Sergei, we want Grigory back too.
Though he tried not to show it, the meeting in Paris left Chamlon deeply shaken. Gabriel's gambit had clearly thrown Ivan off balance, but it had also made him suspicious of a trap. Gabriel's opening would be brief, a few minutes, no more. They would have to move swiftly and decisively. These were the words Chamlon spoke to Gabriel late Wednesday night as they sat together in the back of a CIA car on the rain-lashed tarmac of Shannon Airport. Gabriel's bag was on the seat between them, his eyes focused on the massive C-17 Globemaster that would soon deliver him to Moscow. Chamlon was smoking, despite the fact that the CIA driver had asked him repeatedly not to, and running through the entire operation one more time. Gabriel, though exhausted, listened patiently. The briefing was more for Chamlon's benefit than his. The Mamoune would spend the next 48 hours watching helplessly from the CIA annex. This was his last chance to whisper directly into Gabriel's ear, and he took it without apology. And Gabriel indulged him, because he needed to hear the sound of the old man's voice one more time before getting on that plane. He drew courage from the voice. Faith. It made him believe the operation might actually work, even though everything else told him it was doomed to failure.
"Once you get them into the car, don't stop. Kill anyone you need to kill, and I mean anyone. We'll clean up the mess later. We always do."
Just then there was a knock at the window. It was the CIA escort, saying the plane was ready. Gabriel kissed Chamlon's cheek and told him not to smoke too much. Then he climbed out of the car and headed toward the C-17 through the rain. For now, he was an American, even if he couldn't quite speak like one. He carried an American suitcase filled with American clothes, an American cell phone filled with American numbers, an American BlackBerry filled with American emails. He also carried a second PDA with features not available on ordinary models, but that belonged to someone else. A boy from the Valley of Jezreel. A boy who would have been an artist, if not for a band of Palestinian terrorists known as Black September. Tonight, that boy did not exist. He was a painting lost to time. He was now Aaron Davis of the White House Office of Presidential Advance,
and he had a pocket full of credentials to prove it. He thought American thoughts, dreamed American dreams. He was an American, even if he couldn't quite speak like one, and even if he couldn't quite walk like one either. As it turned out, there was not one presidential limousine on the plane, but two, along with a trio of armored SUVs. The chief of the Secret Service detail was a woman. She escorted Gabriel to a seat near the center of the aircraft and gave him a parka to wear against the sharp cold. Much to his surprise, he was able to get a bit of badly needed sleep, though one agent would later note that he seemed to stir at the precise instant the plane crossed into Russian airspace. He woke with a start 15 minutes before landing, and as the plane descended toward Sheremetyevo, he thought of Kiara. How had she returned to Russia? Had she been bound and gagged? Had she been conscious? Had she been drugged? As the wheels touched down, he forced such questions from his mind. There was no Kiara, he told himself. There was no Yvonne. There was only Aaron Davis, servant of the American president, dreamer of American dreams, who was now just minutes away from his first encounter with Russian authorities. They were waiting on the darkened tarmac, stamping their feet against the bitter cold, as Gabriel and the Secret Service detail filed down the rear cargo ramp. Standing next to the Russian delegation was a pair of officials from the U.S. Embassy, one of whom was an undeclared CIA officer with diplomatic cover. The Russians greeted Gabriel with warm handshakes and smiles, then gave his passport a cursory glance before stamping it. In return, Gabriel gave each a small token of American goodwill, White House cufflinks. 5 minutes later, he was seated in the back of an embassy car, speeding down Leningradsky Prospect toward the city center. Size has always mattered to the Russians, and to spend any time there is to discover nearly everything is the biggest country, the biggest bell, the biggest swimming pool. If the Leningradsky was not the biggest street in the world, it was certainly among the ugliest, a hodgepodge of crumbling apartment houses and Stalinist monstrosities, lit by countless neon signs and piss-yellow street lamps. Capitalism and communism had collided violently on the prospect, and the result was an urban nightmare. The G8 banners the Russians had so carefully hung looked more like warning flags of the fate that awaited them all if they didn't put their financial houses in order. Gabriel felt his stomach tighten by degrees as the car drew closer to the Kremlin. As they passed Dynamo Stadium, the CIA man handed him a satellite photograph of the dacha in the birch forest. There were 3 Range Rovers instead of 2, and 4 men were clearly visible outside. Once again, Gabriel's eye was drawn to the parallel depressions in the woods near the house. It appeared there had been a change since the last pass. At the end of one depression was a dark patch, as if the snow cover had recently been disturbed. By the time Gabriel returned the photo to the CIA man, the car was traveling along Tverskaya Street. Directly before them rose the Kremlin's corner arsenal tower, its red star looking oddly like the symbol of a certain Dutch beer that now flowed freely in the watering holes of Moscow. The darkened offices of Galaxy Travel flashed by Gabriel's window, then the little side street where Anatoly, friend of Viktor Orlov, had been waiting to take Irina to dinner. 100 yards beyond Irina's office, Tverskaya Street emptied into the 12 lanes of Okhotny Ryad Street. They turned left and sped past the Duma, the House of Unions, and the Bolshoi Theater. The next landmark Gabriel saw was a floodlit fortress of yellow stone looming directly ahead over Lubyanka Square, the former headquarters of the KGB, now home to its domestic successor, the FSB. In any other country, the building would have been blown to bits and its horrors exposed to the healing light of day. But not Russia. They had simply hung a new sign and buried its terrible secrets where they couldn't be found. Just down the hill from Lubyanka, in Teatralnye Prospect, was the famed Hotel Metropole. Bag in hand, Gabriel sailed through the Art Deco entrance as if he owned the place, which is how Americans always seem to enter hotels. The lobby, empty and silent, had been faithfully restored to its original decor. Indeed, Gabriel could almost imagine Lenin and his disciples plotting the Red Terror over tea and cakes. The check-in counter was absent any customers. Even so, Gabriel had to wait an eternity before Khrushchev's doppelganger beckoned him forward. After filling out the lengthy registration form, Gabriel refused a bellman's indifferent offer of assistance and made his way upstairs to his room alone. It was now approaching 5 o'clock. He stood in the window, hand to his chin, head tilted to one side, and waited for the sun to rise over Red Square. Chapter 58. Moscow. Though the global financial crisis had caused economic pain across the industrialized world, few countries had fallen further or faster than Russia. Fueled by skyrocketing oil prices, Russia's economy had grown at dizzying speed in the first years of the new millennium, only to come crashing back to earth again with oil's sharp decline. Her stock market was a shambles, her banking system in ruins. Her once docile population was now clamoring for relief. Inside the foreign ministries and intelligence services of the West, there was fear Russia's weakening economy might provoke the Kremlin to retreat even deeper into a Cold War posture, a sentiment shared by several key European leaders who were becoming increasingly dependent on Russia for their supplies of natural gas. It was this concern that had prompted them to hold the emergency G8 summit in Moscow in the dead of winter. Show the bully respect, they reckoned, and he might be encouraged to change his behavior. At least, that was the hope. Had the summit taken place in any other G8 country, the arrival of the leaders and their delegations would scarcely have been a blip on the local media's radar. But the summit was being held in Russia, and Russia, despite protests to the contrary, was not yet a normal country. Its media was either owned by the state or controlled by it, and its television networks went live as each presidential or prime ministerial aircraft sunk out of the iron-gray sky over Sheremetyevo. To hear the Russian reporters explain it, the Western leaders were coming to Moscow because they had been personally summoned by the Russian president. The world was in turmoil, the reporters warned, and only Russia could save it. Inevitably, the American president suffered in comparison. The moment his plane appeared above the horizon, a number of Russian officials and commentators paraded before the cameras to denounce him and all he stood for. The global economic crisis was America's fault, they howled. America had been brought low by greed and hubris, and she was threatening to take the rest of the world down with her. The sun was setting on America, and good riddance. Gabriel found little disagreement in the salons and restaurants of the Hotel Metropole. By mid-morning, it was overrun with reporters and bureaucrats, all proudly wearing their official G8 credentials as if a piece of plastic dangling from a strand of nylon gave them entree to the inner sanctums of power and prestige. Gabriel's credentials were blue, which signified he had access mere mortals did not. They were hanging around his neck as he took a light breakfast beneath the vaulted stained glass ceiling in the famed Metropole restaurant, wielding his BlackBerry throughout the meal like a shield. Leaving the restaurant, he was cornered by a group of French reporters who demanded to know his opinion of the new American stimulus plan. Though Gabriel evaded their questions, the French were clearly impressed by the fact he addressed them fluently in their native language. In the lobby, Gabriel noticed several American reporters clustered around the Teatrónyi prospect entrance and quickly slipped out the back door into Revolution Square. In summer, the Esplanade was crowded with market stalls where it was possible to buy anything from fur hats and nesting dolls to busts of the murderers Lenin and Stalin. Now in the depths of winter, only the bravest dared to venture there. Remarkably, it was clear as snow and ice. When the wind briefly subsided, Gabriel caught a whiff of the de-icer the Russians used to achieve this result. He remembered stories Mikhail had told him about the powerful chemicals Russians poured onto their streets and sidewalks. The stuff could destroy a pair of shoes in a matter of days. Even the dogs refused to walk on it. In springtime, the streetcars used to burst into flames because their wiring had been eaten away by months of exposure. That was how Mikhail had celebrated the arrival of spring as a child in Russia, with the burning of the trams. Gabriel spotted him a moment later, standing next to Elie Levon just outside Resurrection Gate. Levon was holding a briefcase in his right hand, meaning Gabriel had not been followed leaving the Metropole. Moscow rules. Gabriel headed left through the shadowed archway of the gate and entered the vast expanse of Red Square. Standing at the foot of Savior Tower, wearing a heavy overcoat and fur hat, was Uzi Nabot. The tower's gold and black clock face read 11:23. Nabot pretended to set his watch by it.
How was the entry at Sheremetyevo?
No problem.
And the hotel?
No problem.
Good.
Nabot shoved his hands into his pocket.
Let's take a walk, Mr. Davis. It's better if we walk.
They headed toward St. Basil's, heads down, shoulders hunched against the biting wind, the Moscow shuffle. Nabot wished to spend as little time as possible in Gabriel's presence. He wasted no time getting down to business.
We went on to the property last night to have a look around.
Who's we?
Mikhail and Shmuel Peleb from Moscow Station.
He paused, then added,
and me.
Gabriel gave him a sideways glance.
You're here to supervise, Uzi.
Chamron made it clear he didn't want you involved in any direct operation away. You're too senior to get arrested.
Let me see if I understand this correctly.
It's all right for me to tangle with a Russian assassin in a Swiss bank, but it's verboten for me to take a walk in the woods.
Is that what it was, Uzi?
A walk in the woods?
Not quite.
The dacha is set a kilometer back from the road. The track leading to it is bordered by birch forest on both sides. It's tight. Only one vehicle can get through at a time.
Is there a gate?
No gate. But the track is always blocked by security guards and a Range Rover.
How close were you able to get to the dacha?
Close enough to see that Ivan makes two poor bastards stand outside all the time. And close enough to plant a wireless camera.
How's the signal?
Not bad. We'll be fine as long as we don't get 6 feet of snow tonight. We can see the front door, which means we can see if anyone's coming or going.
Who's monitoring the shot?
Shmuel and the girl from Moscow Station.
Where are they?
Holed up in a crummy little hotel in the nearest town. They're pretending to be lovers. Apparently the girl's husband likes to knock her around. Shmuel wants to take her away and start a new life. You know the story, Gabriel.
The satellite photos show guards behind the house.
We saw them, too. They keep at least 3 men back there at all times. They're static, spaced about 100 yards apart. With night vision goggles, we had no trouble seeing them. In daylight, Nabot shrugged his heavy shoulders. They'll go down like targets in a shooting gallery. We'll just have to go in while it's still dark and try not to freeze to death before 9 o'clock.
They had passed St. Basil's and were nearing the southeast corner of the Kremlin.
Directly before them was the Moscow River, frozen and covered by gray-white snow. Nabot nudged Gabriel to the right and led him along the embankment. The wind was now at their backs. After they passed a pair of bored-looking Moscow militiamen, Gabriel asked whether Nabot had seen anything at the dacha to warrant a change in plan. Nabot shook his head.
What about the guns?
The weapons room at the embassy has everything. Just tell me what you want.
A Beretta 92 and a Mini Uzi, both with suppressors.
You sure the Mini will do?
It's going to be tight inside the dacha.
They passed another pair of militiamen. To their right, floating above the red walls of the ancient citadel, was the ornate yellow and white facade of the great Kremlin Palace, where the G8 summit was now underway.
What's the status of the Range Rover?
We took delivery of it last night.
Black?
Of course. Ivan's boys only drive black Range Rovers.
Where did you get it?
A dealership in North Moscow. Chamberlain's going to blow a gasket when he sees the price tag.
License plates?
Taken care of.
How long is the drive from the metropole?
In a normal country, it would be 2.5 hours, tops. Here. Mikhail wants to pick you up at 2 a.m., just to make sure there are no problems.
They had reached the southwestern corner of the Kremlin. On the other side of the river stood a colossal gray apartment building crowned by a revolving Mercedes-Benz star. Known as the House on the Embankment, it had been built by Stalin in 1931 as a palace of Soviet privilege for the most elite members of the nomenklatura. During the Great Terror, he had turned it into a house of horrors. Nearly 800 people, one-third of the building's residents, had been hauled out of their beds and murdered at one of the killing sites that ringed Moscow. Their punishment was virtually always the same. A night of beatings, a bullet in the back of the head, a hasty burial in a mass grave. Despite its blood-soaked history, the house on the embankment was now considered one of Moscow's most exclusive addresses. Ivan Korkov owned a luxury apartment on the 9th floor. It was among his most prized possessions. Gabriel looked at Nabot and noticed he was staring at the sad little park across the street from the apartment building, Volotnaya Square, scene of perhaps the most famous argument in office history.
I should have broken your arm that night. None of this would have happened if I dragged you into the car and pulled you out of Moscow with the rest of the team.
That's true, Uzi. None of it would have happened. We would have never found Ivan's missiles, and Elena Kharkov would be dead.
Nabot ignored the remark.
I can't believe we're back here. I swore to myself I would never set foot in this town again.
He glanced at Gabriel.
Why in God's name would Ivan want to keep an apartment in a place like that?
It's haunted, that building. I can almost hear the screaming.
Elena once told me that her husband was a devout Stalinist. Ivan's house in Zhukovka was built on a plot of land once owned by Stalin's daughter. And when he was looking for a pied-à-terre near the Kremlin, he bought the flat in the house on the embankment. The original owner of Ivan's apartment was a senior man in the foreign ministry. Stalin's henchmen suspected him of being a spy for the Germans. They took him to Butovo and put a bullet in the back of his head. Apparently Ivan loves to tell the story.
Nabot shook his head slowly.
Some people go for nice kitchens and good views, but when Ivan is looking at the place, he demands a bloody pass.
He's unique, our Ivan.
Maybe that explains why he bought several hundred acres of worthless birch forests and swampland outside Moscow.
Yes, thought Gabriel. Maybe it did.
He looked back down the Kremlin embankment and saw Elie Levon approaching, briefcase still in his right hand. As Levon walked past, he gave Gabriel a little jab in the small of his back. It meant the meeting had gone on long enough. Nabot removed his glove and extended his hand.
Go back to the Metropole, keep your head down, and try not to worry, we'll get her back.
Gabriel shook Nabot's hand, then turned and headed back toward Resurrection Gate. Though Nabot did not know it, Gabriel disobeyed the order to return to his room at the Hotel Metropole, and made his way to Tverskaya Street instead. Pausing outside the office building at number 6, he stared at the posters in the window of Galaxy Travel. One showed a Russian couple sharing a champagne lunch along the ski slopes of Courchevel. The other, a pair of Russian nymphs tanning themselves on the beaches of the Côte d'Azur. The irony seemed lost on Irina Volganova, former wife of the defector Grigory Bolganov, who was seated primly at her desk, telephone to her ear. There were many things Gabriel wanted to tell her, but couldn't. Not yet. And so he stood there, alone, watching her through the frosted glass. Reality is a state of mind, he thought. Reality can be whatever you want it to be.
Chapter 59 Grosvenor Square, London. If Gabriel earned high marks for his grace under pressure during the final hours before the operation, the same, unfortunately, could not be said of Ari Shamron. Upon his return to London, he made a base camp for himself inside the Israeli embassy in Kensington, and used it to launch raids on targets stretching from Tel Aviv to Langley. The officers on the ops desk at Kingsall Boulevard grew so weary of Shamron's outbursts, they drew lots to determine who would have the misfortune of taking his calls. Only Adrian Carter managed not to lose patience with him. As a grounded field man himself, he knew the feeling of utter helplessness Shamron was experiencing. The extraction plan was Gabriel's. Shamron could only operate the levers and pull the strings. And even then, he was heavily dependent on Carter and the agency. It violated Shamron's core faith in the principle of Achol Balaban. Left to his own devices, the old man would have walked into Ivan's dacha in the woods and done the job himself. And only a fool would have bet against him.
He's done things none of us can imagine, Carter said in Shamron's defense. And he's got the scars to prove it.
At 6 p.m. that evening, Shamron headed to the American Embassy in Mayfair for the opening act. A young CIA officer, a fresh-faced girl who looked as though she had just finished her junior year abroad, greeted him in Upper Brook Street. She escorted him past the Marine Guard, then into a secure elevator that bore him downward into the bowels of the annex. Adrian Carter and Graham Seymour were already there, seated on the top deck of the amphitheater-shaped ops center. Shamron took a seat at Carter's right, and looked at one of the large screens at the front of the room. It showed two aircraft sitting on a tarmac outside Washington, D.C. Both belonged to the 89th Airlift Wing based at Andrews Air Force Base. Both were fueled and ready for departure. At 7 p.m., Carter's telephone rang. He brought the receiver swiftly to his ear, listened in silence for a few seconds, then hung up.
He's pulling up to the gate. It looks like we're on, gentlemen.
There was a time in Washington when everyone in government and journalism could recite the name of the Soviet ambassador to the United States. But these days, few people outside Foggy Bottom and the State Department press corps had ever heard of Konstantin Tretyakov. Though fluent in English, the Russian Federation's ambassador rarely appeared on television and never through parties anyone would bother to attend. He was a forgotten man in a city where Moscow's envoy had once been treated almost like a head of state. Tretyakov was the worst thing a person could be in Washington. He was irrelevant. The ambassador's official CV described him as an American expert and career diplomat who had served in many important Western posts. It left out the fact his career had nearly been derailed in Oslo when he was caught with his hand in the embassy's petty cash drawer. Nor did it mention that he occasionally drank too much, or that he had one brother who worked as a spy for the SVR and another who was part of the Russian president's inner circle of Siloviki at the Kremlin. All this unflattering material, however, was contained in the CIA's dossier, a copy of which had been given to Ed Fielding to assist in his preparation for the Andrews end of the operation. The CIA security man had found the file highly entertaining. He had joined the agency in the darkest days of the Cold War, and had spent several decades fighting the Soviets and their proxies on secret battlefields around the globe. A glance at the ambassador's file reassured Fielding his career had not been in vain. He was standing beneath the crest of the 89th Airlift Wing when Tretyakov's motorcade drew to a halt outside the passenger terminal. Despite the fact the ambassador was now inside one of the most secure facilities in the National Capital Region, he was protected by three layers of security, his own Russian bodyguards, a detail of diplomatic security agents, and several officers from Andrew's base security. Fielding had no trouble picking out the ambassador when he emerged from the back of the limousine. The dossier had contained a copy of Tretyakov's official portrait, along with several surveillance photos, but Fielding covered his preparation by approaching the ambassador's factotum instead. The aide corrected Fielding by pointing to Tretyakov, who now had a superior smile on his face, as if amused by American incompetence. Fielding pumped the ambassador's hand and introduced himself as Tom Harris. Apparently, Mr. Harris had no title or reason for being at Andrews other than to shake the ambassador's hand.
As you can probably guess, Mr. Ambassador, the Kharkov children are a little nervous. Mrs. Kharkov would like you to see them alone, without aids or security.
Why would the children be nervous, Mr. Harris? They're going back to Russia, where they belong.
Are you saying you refuse to meet Anna and Nikolai without aides or bodyguards, Mr. Ambassador? Because if that's the case, the deal is off.
The ambassador raised his chin a bit. No, Mr. Harris, that is not the case.
Wise decision. I would hate to think what would happen if Ivan Kharkov ever found out you personally blew the deal to get his children back over some silly question of protocol.
What's your tone, Mr. Harris?
Fielding had no intention of watching his tone. In fact, he was just getting started.
I take it you've seen photographs of the Kharkov children?
The ambassador nodded.
You're confident you can identify them by sight?
Very.
That's good, because under no circumstances are you to approach or touch the children. You may ask them two questions, no more. Are these conditions acceptable to you, Mr. Ambassador?
What choice do I have?
None whatsoever.
That's what I thought.
Please extend your arms straight out from your side and spread your feet.
Why on earth would I do that?
Because I have to search you before letting you anywhere near those children.
This is outrageous.
I would hate for Ivan Kharkov to find out you...
The ambassador extended his arms and spread his feet. Fielding took his time with the search and made sure it was as invasive and mortifying as possible. When the search was over, he squirted liquid desanitizer on his hands.
Two questions, no touching. Are we clear, Mr. Ambassador?
We are clear, Mr. Harris.
Follow me, please.
It was a small room, hung with photographs of the installation's storied past, presidents departing on historic journeys, POWs returning from years of captivity, flag-draped coffins coming home for burial in American soil. Had photographers been present that afternoon, they would have captured an image of great sadness, a mother holding her children, possibly for the last time. But there were no photographers, of course, because the mother and children were not there, at least not officially.
As for the two flights that would soon tear this family apart, they did not exist either, and no records of them would ever find their way into the control tower's logbook. They were huddled together along a couch of black vinyl. Elena, dressed in blue jeans and a shearling coat, was seated in the center, an arm around each child. Their faces were buried in her collar, and they remained that way long after the Russian ambassador entered the room. Elena refused to look at him. Her lips were pressed to Anna's forehead, her gaze focused on the pale gray carpet.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Gorkov," the ambassador said in Russian.
Elena made no response. The ambassador looked at Fielding. In English, he said,
"I need to see their faces, otherwise I cannot confirm that these are indeed the children of Ivan Karkov."
"You have two questions, Mr. Ambassador. Ask them to lift their faces, but make certain you ask them nicely. Otherwise I might get upset." The ambassador looked at the distraught family seated before him. In Russian, he asked,
"Please, children, lift your faces so I can see them."
The children remained motionless.
"Try speaking to them in English," said Fielding.
Prechikov did as Fielding suggested. This time the children raised their faces and stared at the ambassador with undisguised hostility. Prechikov appeared satisfied the children were indeed Anna and Nikolai Karkov.
"Your father is looking forward to seeing you. Are you excited about going home?"
"No,"
said Anna.
"No,"
repeated Nikolai.
"We want to stay here with our mother."
"Perhaps your mother should come home too."
Elena looked at Prechikov for the first time. Then her gaze moved to Fielding.
"Please take him away, Mr. Harris. His presence is beginning to make me ill."
Fielding escorted the ambassador next door to the base ops building. They were standing together on the observation deck when Elena and the children emerged from the passenger terminal, accompanied by several security officers. The group moved slowly across the tarmac and climbed the passenger boarding stairs to the door of the C-32. Elena Karkov emerged 10 minutes later without the children, visibly shaken. Clinging to the arm of an Air Force officer, she walked over to a Gulfstream and disappeared into the cabin.
"You must be very proud, Mr. Ambassador," Fielding said.
"You had no right to take them from their father in the first place."
The cabin door of the C-32 was now closed. The boarding stairs moved away, followed by the fuel and catering trucks. 5 minutes after that, the plane was rising over the Maryland suburbs of Washington. Fielding watched it disappear into the clouds, then looked contemptuously at the ambassador.
9 a.m. at the Konakovo airfield. Remember, no Ivan, no children, are we clear, Mr. Ambassador?
He'll be there.
You're free to leave. You'll forgive me if I don't shake your hand. I'm feeling a bit ill myself.
Ed Fielding remained on the observation deck until the ambassador and his entourage were safely off base, then boarded the waiting Gulfstream. Elena Karkov was buckled into her seat, eyes fixed on the deserted tarmac.
"How long do we have to wait?"
"Not long, Elena. Are you going to be all right?"
"I'll be fired. Let's go home."
Chapter 60. Hotel Metropole, Moscow. Gabriel was notified of the plane's departure at 10:45 p.m. Moscow time while standing in the window of his room at the Metropole. He had been there, on and off, since returning from his foray into Tverskaya Street. 10 hours with nothing to do but pace the floor and make himself sick with worry. 10 hours with nothing to do but picture the operation from beginning to end 1,000 times. 10 hours with nothing to do but think about Ivan. He wondered how his enemy would spend this night. Would he spend it quietly with his child bride? Or perhaps a celebration was in order. A blowout. That was the word Ivan and his cohorts used to describe the parties thrown at the conclusion of a major arms deal. The bigger the deal, the bigger the blowout. With the children's plane now bound for Russia, Gabriel felt his nerves turn to piano wire. He tried to slow his racing heart, but his body refused his commands. He tried to close his eyes, but saw only satellite photos of the little dacha in the birch forest, and the room where Kiara and Grigori were surely being kept chained and bound, and the 4 streams that converged in a great marshland, and the parallel depressions in the woods.
My husband is a devout Stalinist. His love of Stalin has influenced his real estate purchases.
The secure PDA helped pass the time. It told him that Naboth, Yakov, and Oded were proceeding to the target. It told him that the concealed camera had detected no change at the dacha or in the disposition of Ivan's forces. It told him that God had granted them a heavy ground fog over the marshes to help conceal their approach. And finally, at 1:48 a.m., it told him that it was nearly time to leave. Gabriel had dressed long ago and was sweating beneath layer upon layer of protective clothing. He forced himself to remain in the room a few minutes longer, then switched off the lights and slipped quietly into the corridor. As the clock in the lobby tolled 2 a.m., he stepped from the elevator and passed Khrushchev's doppelganger with a curt nod. The Range Rover was waiting at the Alpranyi Prospect, engine running. Mikhail drummed his fingers nervously as they swept up the hill toward FSB headquarters.
You okay, Mikhail?
I'm fine, boss.
You're not nervous, are you?
Why would I be nervous? I love being around Lubyanka. The KGB kept my father in there for 6 months when I was a kid.
Did I ever tell you that, Gabriel?
He had.
Do you have the guns?
Plenty.
Radios?
Of course.
Sat phone?
Gabriel, please.
Coffee?
Two thermoses. One for us, one for them.
What about the bolt cutters?
A pair for each of us, just in case.
In case of what?
One of us goes down.
Nobody's going down except Ivan's guards.
But the police save us.
Mikhail resumed his tapping.
You're not going to do that all the way.
I'll try not to.
That's good, because you're giving me a headache.
Moscow refused to relinquish its grip on them without a fight. It took 30 minutes just to get from Lubyanka to the MKAD Outer Ring Road. 30 minutes of traffic jams, broken signal lights, sinkholes, crime scenes, and unexplained militia roadblocks.
And it's 2 a.m,
Mikhail said in exasperation.
Imagine what it's like during the evening rush, when half of Moscow is trying to get home at the same time.
If it continues like this, we won't have to imagine.
Once beyond the city, the massive apartment houses began to gradually disappear, only to be replaced by mile after mile of smoking rail yards and factories. They were, of course, the biggest factories Gabriel had ever seen, behemoths with towering smokestacks and scarcely a light burning anywhere. A freight train rattled by, heading in the opposite direction. It seemed to take an eternity to pass. It was 5 miles long, thought Gabriel. Or perhaps it was 100. Surely, it was the world's longest. They were driving on the M7. It ran eastward into Russia's vast middle, all the way through Tatarstan. And if you were feeling really adventurous, Mikhail explained, you could hit the Trans-Siberian in Ufa and drive to Mongolia and China.
China! Gabriel, can you imagine driving to China?
Actually, Gabriel could. The sheer scale of the place made anything possible. The endless black sky filled with hard white stars, the vast frozen plains dotted with slumbering towns and villages, the unbearable cold. In some of the villages, he could see onion domes shining in the bright moonlight. Ivan's hero had been hard on the churches of Russia. He'd ordered Kaganovich to dynamite Moscow's Cathedral of Christ the Savior in 1931, supposedly because it blocked the view from the windows of his Kremlin apartment. And in the countryside, he'd turned the churches into barns and grain silos. Some were now being restored. Others, like the villages they once served, were in ruins. It was Russia's dirty little secret. The glitz and glamour of Moscow was matched only by the poverty and deprivation of the countryside. Moscow got the money. The villages got absentee governors and the occasional visit from some Kremlin flunky. They were the places you left behind to make your fortune in the big city. They were for the losers. In the villages, you did nothing but drink and curse the rich bastards in Moscow. They flashed through a string of towns, each more desolate than the last. Lakinsk, Dnipro, Warsaw. Ahead lay Vladimir, capital of the oblast. Its five-domed cathedral of the Assumption had been the model for all the cathedrals of Russia. The cathedral Stalin had destroyed or turned into pig pens. Mikhail explained that people had been living in and around Vladimir for 25,000 years, an impressive statistic even for a boy from the Valley of Jezreel. 25,000 years, Gabriel thought. gazing out at the broken factories on the city's western outskirts. Why had they come? Why had they stayed? Reclining his seat, he saw an image of his last late-night drive through the Russian countryside. Olga and Elena sleeping in the back seat, Grigory behind the wheel. Promise me one thing, Gabriel. At least then they had been driving out of Russia, not directly into the belly of the beast. Mikhail found a news bulletin on the radio and provided simultaneous translation while he drove. The first day of the G8 summit had gone well, at least from the point of view of the Russian president, which was the only one that mattered. Then, by some miracle of atmospheric conditions, Mikhail found a BBC bulletin in English. There had been an important political development in Zimbabwe, a fatal plane crash in South Korea, and in Afghanistan, Taliban forces had carried out a major raid in Kabul. With the Von's guns, no doubt. Is it possible to drive to Afghanistan from here?
Sure,
said Mikhail. He then proceeded to recite the road numbers and the distances, while Vladimir, center of human habitation for 25 millennia, receded once more into the darkness. They listened to the BBC until the signal became too faint to hear. Then Mikhail switched off the radio and again began drumming his fingers on the steering wheel.
Something bothering you, Mikhail?
Maybe we should talk about it.
I'd feel better if we ran through it a couple of hundred times.
That's not like you. I need you to be confident.
It's your wife in there, Gabriel. I hate to think that something I did...
You're going to be just fine. But if you want to run through it a couple of hundred times... Gabriel's voice trailed off as he looked out at the limitless frozen landscape. It's not as if we have anything better to do. Mikhail's voice dropped in pitch slightly as he began to speak about the operation. The key to everything, he said, would be speed. They had to overwhelm them quickly. A sentry will always hesitate for an instant, even when confronted with someone he doesn't know. That instant would be their opening. They would take it swiftly and decisively.
And no gunfights, Mikhail said. Gunfights are for cowboys and gangsters.
Mikhail was neither. He was Sayaret Matkal, the most elite unit on Earth. The Sayaret had pulled off operations other units could only dream of. It had done on Tebi and Sabena, and jobs much harder that no one would ever read about. Mikhail had dispensed death to the terror masterminds of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. He had even crossed into Lebanon and killed members of Hezbollah. They had been hellish operations, carried out in crowded cities and refugee camps. Not one had failed. Not a single terrorist targeted by Mikhail was still walking the earth. A dacha in a birch forest was nothing for a man like him. Ivan's guards were special forces themselves, Alpha Group and Oman. Even so, Mikhail spoke of them only in the past tense. As far as he was concerned, they were already dead. Silence, speed, and timing would be the key. Silence, speed, timing. Shamron's holy trinity. Unlike Mikhail, Gabriel had never carried out assassinations in the West Bank or Gaza, and for the most part had managed to avoid operating in Arab countries. One notable exception was Abu Jihad, the nom de guerre of Khalil al-Wazir, the second highest-ranking figure in the PLO after Yasser Arafat. Like all Sayaret recruits, Mikhail had studied every aspect of the operation during his training, but he had never asked Gabriel about that night. He did so now as they thundered along the deserted highway, and Gabriel obliged him, though he would regret it later. Abu Jihad. Even now the sound of his name put ice at the back of Gabriel's neck. In April of 1988, this symbol of Palestinian suffering was living in splendid exile in Tunis, in a large villa near the beach. Gabriel had personally surveyed the house and the surrounding district, and had overseen the construction of a duplicate in the Negev, where they had rehearsed for several weeks prior to the operation. On the night of the hit, he had come ashore in a rubber boat and climbed into a waiting van. In a matter of minutes, it was over. There had been a guard outside the house, dozing behind the wheel of a Mercedes. Gabriel had shot him through the ear with a silenced Beretta. Then, with the help of his Sayaret escorts, he had blown the front door off the hinges with a special explosive that emitted little more sound than a hand clap. After killing a second guard in the front entrance hall, Gabriel had crept quietly up the stairs to Abu Jihad's study. So silent was Gabriel's approach that the PLO mastermind never heard a thing. He died at his desk while watching a videotape of the Intifada. silence, speed, timing. Shamron's holy trinity.
And afterward?
Mikhail asked softly.
Afterward.
A scene from Gabriel's nightmares. Leaving the study, he had run straight into Abu Jahad's wife. She was clutching a small boy to her breast in terror, and clinging to the arm of her teenage daughter. Gabriel looked at the woman, and in Arabic shouted, "Go back to your room!" Then he had said calmly to the girl, "Go and take care of your mother.
Go and take care of your mother."
There were few nights when he did not see the face of that child, and he saw it now, as they turned off the highway and headed into the northernmost reaches of the oblast. Sometimes, Gabriel wondered whether he would have pulled the trigger had he known the girl was standing at his back. And sometimes, in his darker moments, he wondered whether everything that had befallen him since was not God's punishment for killing a man in front of his family. Now, as he had done countless times before, he nudged the child gently from his thoughts and watched as Mikhail made another turn, this time into a dense stand of pine and fir. The headlamps went dark, the engine silent.
How far is the property?
2 miles.
How long to make the drive?
5 minutes. We'll take it nice and slow.
You're sure, Mikhail? Timing is everything.
I've done it twice, I'm sure.
Mikhail began drumming his fingers on the console. Gabriel ignored him and looked at the clock. 6:25.
The waiting.
Waiting for the sun to rise before a morning of killing. Waiting to hold Kiara in his arms. Waiting for the child of Abu Jihad to forgive him. He poured himself a cup of coffee and loaded his weapons. 6:26. 6:27. 6:28. The sun set fire to the snowbank. Kiara did not know whether it was sunrise or sunset, but as the light fell upon Grigori's sleeping face, she had a premonition of death, so clear that it seemed a stone had been laid over her heart. She heard the sound of the latch and watched as the woman with milk-white skin and translucent eyes entered the cell. The woman had food, stale bread, cold sausage, tea in paper cups. Whether it was breakfast or dinner, Kiara was not certain. The woman withdrew, locking the door behind her. Kiara held her tea between shackled hands and looked at the burning snowbank. As usual, the light remained only a few minutes. Then the fire was extinguished, and the room plunged once more into pitch blackness. Chapter 61. Konakovo, Russia. Like Russia itself, the airfield at Konakovo had been a two-time loser. Abandoned by the Air Force shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union, it was allowed to crumble into a state of ruin before finally being taken over by a consortium of businessmen and civic leaders. For a brief period, it experienced modest success as a commercial cargo facility, only to see its fortunes plummet a second time with the price of Russian crude. The airfield now handled fewer than a dozen flights a week and was used mainly as a rest home for decaying Anatovs, Ilyushins, and Tupolevs. But its runway, at 12,000 feet, was still one of the longest in the region, and its landing lights and radar systems functioned well by Russian standards, which is to say they worked most of the time. All systems were in good working order that Friday morning, and great effort had been made to plow and treat the runway and tarmac, and with good reason. The control tower had been informed by the Kremlin that an American Air Force C-32 would be landing at Konakovo at 9 a.m. sharp. What's more, a delegation of hotshots from the Foreign Ministry and Customs would be on hand to greet the aircraft and expedite arrival procedures. Airport authorities had not been told the identity of the arriving passengers, and they knew far better than to press the matter. One didn't ask too many questions when the Kremlin was involved, not unless one wanted the FSB knocking on one's door. The Moscow delegation arrived shortly after 8, and was waiting at the edge of the windswept tarmac when a string of lights appeared against the overcast sky to the south. A few of the officials initially mistook the lights for the American plane, which was not possible, since the C-32 was still 100 miles out, and would be landing from the west, not the southeast. As the lights drew closer, the brittle air was filled with the beating of rotors. There were 3 helicopters in all, and even from a long way off it was clear they were not of Russian manufacture. Someone in the control tower identified them as custom-fitted Bell 427s. Someone in the delegation said that would make sense,
Ivan Kharkov might be willing to put a load of weapons on a Russian rust bucket, but when it came to his family, he only flew American. The helicopters settled onto the tarmac, and one by one killed their engines. From the two flanking aircraft emerged a security detail fit for a Russian president. Big boys, well-groomed, heavily armed, hard as nails. After establishing a perimeter around the third helicopter, one guard stepped forward and opened the cabin door. For a long moment, no one appeared. Then came a flash of lustrous blonde hair, framing a face of Slavic youth and perfection. The features were instantly recognizable to the control tower, as well as the members of the Moscow delegation. The woman had appeared on countless magazine covers and billboards, usually with far less clothing than she was wearing now. Her name had once been Yekaterina Mazurov. Now she was known as Yekaterina Kharkov. Though meticulously coiffed and painted, she was clearly on edge. Immediately after placing an elegant boot on the tarmac, she gave one of the bodyguards a good tongue-lashing, which unfortunately could not be heard. Someone in the Moscow delegation pointed out that Yekaterina's anxiety was to be forgiven. She was about to become a mother of two, and was still little more than a child herself. The second person to emerge from the helicopter was a trim man in a dark overcoat, with a face that hinted of ancestors from deep in Russia's interior. He was holding a cell phone to his ear, and appeared to be engaged in a conversation of great import. No one in the control tower or the Moscow delegation recognized him, which was hardly surprising. Unlike the ravishing Yekaterina, this man's photograph never appeared in the papers, and few people outside the insular world of the Siloviki and the oligarchs knew his name. He was Oleg Rudenko, a former colonel in the KGB, who now served as chief of Ivan Kharkov's personal security service. Even Rudenko was the first to admit the title was merely an honorific. Ivan called all the shots. Rudenko just made the trains run on time. Thus, the cell phone pressed tightly to his ear, and the grim expression on his face. The interval between Rudenko and the emergence of the third passenger was 84 long seconds, as timed by the control tower staff. He was an immensely powerful-looking figure, somewhat short in stature, with angular cheekbones, a pugilist's broad forehead, and coarse hair the color of steel wool. One of the officials briefly confused him for a bodyguard, which was a common mistake, and one he secretly enjoyed. But any inclination to such thinking was immediately dispelled by the cut of his magnificent English overcoat, and by the manner in which his trousers broke across his handmade English shoes, and by the way his own bodyguards seemed to fear his very presence, and by the sundial-sized gold watch on his left wrist.
"Look at him," murmured someone in the Moscow delegation. "Look at Ivan Borisovich."
The controversy, the arrest warrants, the indictments in the West, any one of them would have gladly accepted it all, just to live like Ivan Borisovich for a day, just to ride in his helicopters and his limousines, and just to climb into bed one time with Yekaterina.
But why the frown, Ivan Borisovich? Today is a joyous occasion. Today is the day your children are coming home from America.
He strode across the tarmac, Yekaterina on one side, Rudenko on the other, bodyguards all around. The head of the delegation, Deputy Foreign Minister so-and-so of Department such-and-such, met him halfway. The conversation was brief and, by all appearances, unpleasant. Afterward, each retreated to his respective corner. When asked to recount what Ivan had said, the deputy refused. It couldn't be repeated in polite company.
"Look at him. Look at Ivan Borisovich. The fancy American helicopter, the beautiful young wife, the mountain of money. And underneath it all, he was still a KGB hood. A KGB hood in a fancy English suit."
Like Oleg Rudenko, Adrian Carter was at that moment holding a telephone to his ear, a secure landline device connected directly to the Global Ops Center at Langley. Chamron had a phone to his ear as well, though his was connected to the operations desk at Kingsall Boulevard. He was staring at the clock, while at the same time battling a crippling craving for nicotine. Smoking was strictly forbidden in the annex. So, apparently, was speaking, because Carter had not uttered a word in several minutes.
"Well, Adrian, is he there or not?"
Carter nodded his head vigorously.
"The spotter just confirmed it. Ivan's birds are on the ground."
"How long until the plane gets there?"
7 minutes.
Chamron
Ron looked at the Moscow clock. 8:53.
Cutting it a little close, aren't they?
Refinery.
Just make sure they switch on those jammers at 9:05, Adrian. Not a second sooner, not a second later.
Don't worry, Harry. No phone calls for Yvonne, no phone calls for anyone.
Chamron looked at the clock. 8:54. Silence, speed, timing. All they needed now was a bit of luck.
Had Uzi Nabot been privy to Chamron's thoughts, he would have surely recited the office maxim that luck is always earned, never bestowed. He would have done so because at that moment he was lying on his face in the snow, 100 yards behind the dacha, a weapon bearing his name cradled in his arms. 50 yards to his right, in precisely the same position, was Yakov, and 50 yards to his left was Oded. Standing directly in front of each of them was a Russian. It had been 5 hours since Nabot and the others had crept into position through the birch forest. In that time, 2 shifts of guards had come and gone. There had been no relief, of course, for the visiting team. Nabot, though properly outfitted for such an operation, was trembling with cold. He assumed Yakov and Oded were suffering as well, though he had not spoken to either man in several hours. Radio silence was the order of the morning. Nabot was tempted to feel sorry for himself, but his mind would not allow it. Whenever the cold started to eat at his bones, he thought about the camps and the ghettos and the terrible winters his people had endured during the Shoah. Like Gabriel, Nabot owed his very existence to someone who had summoned the courage, the will, to survive those winters. A paternal grandfather who had spent 5 years toiling in the Nazi labor camps. 5 years living on starvation rations. 5 years sleeping in the cold. It was because of his grandfather that Nabot had joined the office. And it was because of his grandfather that he was lying in the snow, 100 yards behind a dacha, surrounded by birch trees. The Russian standing before him would soon be dead. For Nabot was not an expert like Gabriel and Mikhail. He had done his obligatory time in the army and had undergone extensive weapons training at the academy. So too had Yakov and Oded. For them, 50 yards was nothing, even with frozen hands, even with suppressors. And there would be no going for the comfort zone of the torso. Only headshots. No dying calls on the radio. Nabok rolled his left wrist toward him a few degrees and glanced at his digital watch. 8:59. 6 more minutes to contend with the cold. He flexed his fingers and waited for the sound of Gabriel's voice in his miniature earpiece. The second and final session of the emergency G8 summit convened at the stroke of 9 in the ornate St. George's Hall of the Great Kremlin Palace. As always, the American president arrived precisely on time and settled into his place at the breakfast table. As luck would have it, the British prime minister had been placed to his right. The Russian president was seated opposite between the German chancellor and the Italian prime minister, his 2 closest allies in Western Europe. His attention, however, was clearly focused on the Anglo-American side of the table. Indeed, he had fixed both English-speaking leaders with his trademark stare, the one he always adopted when he was trying to look tough and decisive to the Russian people.
"Do you think he knows?" asked the British Prime Minister.
"Are you kidding? He knows everything."
"Will it work?"
"We'll know soon enough.
I only hope no harm comes to that woman."
The President sipped his coffee.
"No woman."
Stalin was never quite able to get his hands on Somoskvoretzhye. The streets of his pleasant old quarter just south of the Kremlin were largely spared the horror of Soviet replanning and are still lined with grand imperial houses and onion-domed churches. The district is also home to the embassy of the State of Israel, which stands at Bolshaya Ordenka 56. Ramona was waiting just inside the security gate, flanked by a pair of Shin Bet embassy guards. Like Uzi Nabot, she was watching a single object, an S-Class Mercedes sedan, which had pulled to the curb outside the embassy at the stroke of 9. The car was crouched low over its wheels, weighed down by armor plating and bulletproof windows. The glass was also blacked out, which made it impossible for Ramona to see into the passenger seats. All she could make out was the driver's chin and a pair of hands resting calmly on the wheel. Ramona raised her secure cell phone to her ear and heard the cacophony of the ops desk at King Saul Boulevard. Then the voice of a desk officer, pleading for information.
The plane is on the ground. Tell us if she's there. Tell us what you see.
Ramona complied with the order. She saw a Mercedes car with blacked-out windows, and she saw a pair of hands resting on the wheel. And then, in her mind, she saw a pair of angels sitting in a Range Rover. A pair of angels who would create hell on Earth unless Kiara got out of that car.